You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 20th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ray Raphael, on our constitutional and founding myths. Also on the program today, State of the Union address tonight, and about 14 Republican responses. We've got the Tea Party response, the Tea Party Express response, the Tea Party Patriots response, the Republican response. They get a bunch of responses. I wonder if that's going to happen if a Republican is ever president again in this country. Also on the program today, remember how for 2 weeks Fox was talking about all those no-go zones in Europe? Turns out they made a mistake there. There are no no-go zones, and they apologize for it. Speaking of apologies, Governor Sam Brownback of Kansas, his plan, his laffer plan to cut income taxes is going so perfectly that they're going to slightly rejigger the plan. The richest 1% in the world is on the precipice of owning more than the rest of the world combined. And if a lawmaker in South Carolina has his way, there'll be a 3 weeks worth of NRA propaganda taught every year in school. And Bobby Jindal, there's something I think he's allergic to this time of year. Because remember how I just talked about how Fox was saying there were no-go zones for about 2 weeks and then had to apologize across every channel, every show on their network? Apparently, Bobby Jindal, who's in London, doesn't get Fox News there, and went and gave a major foreign policy speech where he just reiterated all of Fox's just 24 hours earlier retracted claims. We will talk about
guy's
that.
Guy's pursuing his dreams. Give him a break.
Indeed. Indeed. All that and more. Folks, want to point your attention. You'll notice at the beginning of this program, almost every day, I mentioned the three awards that the Majority Report has won. That is the Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. And we have won really for three of the 4 years, but the fourth year is still undecided.
It's now, yeah.
Right. So it's now. It's we're looking for the 2014 best podcast. And nominations have now opened at podcastawards.com. We want you to head over there and nominate us for People's Choice and for Politics News. People's Choice and Politics News.
You have to type out the Majority Report.
Yes, and you should put in the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. That way, if somebody else has a Majority Report or just – it's just more to search for. more search terms. So the Majority Report with Sam Cedar in the either People's Choice or Best News in Politics.
No, you could do both.
No, you can do both. Exactly. Sorry about that. Nominate
so
us for both.
Please do both, especially the News and Politics one, actually, because that's the one where we'll
that's
be,
the one
we'll
that we've won
straight,
consistently.
Yeah.
And we're going to need you to vote for that in the coming weeks. But it'll just take you a minute. You head over there, nominate us. Be much appreciated. All right, when we come back, author of The People's History of the American Revolution, Founding Myths, Stories That Hide Our Patriotic Past, and his latest on constitutional myths, what we get wrong and how to get it right. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Ray Raphael. He is the author of over a half dozen books, including Founding Myths, Stories That Hide Our Patriotic Past. Also, his most recent Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right, will be released, or I should say was released a little more than a year plus ago. Welcome to the program, Ray.
Well, nice to be talking to you again.
Now, Ray, one of the things, I mean, I want to focus on the constitutional myths, but one talk of yours that I've seen that I found, I think is where I first sort of became aware of your work was a talk you gave at Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass. I am a Worcester, Mass. Native, and you spoke of a moment in our nation's history and in Worcester's history of a rebellion of sorts. What you described is the moment that political and military authority began to shift in this country. And you spoke about how that is a moment that gets very little attention in our retelling of history. And use that as an example of the difference between history and heritage. Tell us about that difference.
Well, yeah. Let's just use that example. Our heritage is that the shot heard around the world, Lexington and Concord. That was the beginning of the American Revolution. And we become so attached to that story. And it was, of course, a very significant story, the first firing of guns. But you know, the idea that was the start of everything, and that Paul Revere, another part of our heritage, rode from Boston to wake up the sleepy-eyed farmers, and then they all show up with their muskets and drive the bad British away. This hides this amazing revolution that happened the year before that in 1774. And what happened was everybody talks about the Boston Port Act and they punished Boston, and so somehow we had a revolution. But what people in Massachusetts were upset by was the Massachusetts Government Act, which revoked their constitution. Now, we're going to be talking today about our constitution. Now, imagine if your constitution is revoked, just, you know, outright, just revoke the constitution and totally disenfranchise the people. Well, people throughout Massachusetts were very upset. They said, we are going to shut down the government. And they did it in Berkshire for the government at the county level was done through the courts. That was not only judicial, but it was also executive functioning of imperial government. And so in Berkshire was the first court to be scheduled. They closed that. They closed it in Springfield. Those were far from Boston. And General Gage, who was the governor of Massachusetts and the commander-in-chief of the forces in British forces in North America, said, I'm going to hold the line at Worcester, which was the next court. And Worcester is only about 40 miles from Boston. But he didn't. He didn't because he got totally scared because the people were so overwhelmingly united. So on that day, 4,622 militiamen from 37 towns lined up in their 37 militia companies come all across the county. You know, this is a rural county with half the adult male population of the entire county. And they show, imagine getting half the adult males in a sprawling rural county to show up once, you know. And they close the courts, and they have the crown-appointed officials walk the gauntlet between them with the hats in the hands, reciting the recantations over 30 times. Remarkable event. And yet we get so attached to these stories that are our heritage, we overlook history. I mean, the documentation is amazing for that. You know, we have the firsthand diary of the guy who counted all the people and where they stood on Main Street. Why was that overlooked? Because we get locked into one story, and we tell it over and over. So that's kind of the premise of founding this, and to some extent the premise of constitutional myth.
And let me just I want to just tease one other point out from that before we talk specifically about constitutional myths. And I know part of the reason why you discussed why one narrative gets precedence, I guess, over another, even if it's not necessarily the most historically accurate. I mean, and some of that, obviously, I think people understand because we see that in today's dynamics, certain stories are just sort of sexier in some respects. You know, they bleed or they involve, you know, certain heroes or popular people or whatnot. Is there how much of it is that those people who controlled at the time and through the years the means of distributing a narrative didn't like that earlier narrative for some because it somehow impinged upon their own power or sense of self?
There's some truth in that, but it's not the whole truth because everybody has a hand in these perpetuation of these myths for diverse reasons. But like, for instance, in the founding myth there, that one, that story I told you, people told about that revolution in the early tellings of the revolution. It was featured in the first histories of the American Revolution. By contemporaries. They didn't expand on the Worcester story, but they did tell about the overthrow of government in Massachusetts. But then in the early 19th century, people tried to downplay, the writers of textbooks and tried to downplay the idea of a rebellion because their job was to consolidate the country and they didn't want people thinking anti-government. So they kind of tried to downplay that, and they even expunged the word rebel, and they didn't put it in there anymore. And then we developed the myths, like Paul Revere and Samuel Adams, you know, directed the whole revolution, one man, and so on. And he wasn't even there, so we didn't tell that story. But it's more complicated than just like, you know, those in power, because certain ideologies become dominant, and then they just get told by, and it's not, you know, they just become the national story. I can give you some examples from constitutional myths or what.
Yeah, let's do that. But is there a name to that? I mean, when you reference that, you want a shorthand saying like, that's just like what is it called? It's not Shay's Rebellion, right? I mean, that Shay's Rebellion happens, 30 years later. But
that's right.
There's no name.
That's a great point, Sam, because naming is half the battle. And, like, let's take Shay's Rebellion. Shay's Rebellion was an attempt to repeat at that. Can you imagine? Shay's Rebellion, and even the histories of Shay's Rebellion don't tell this. It happened 12 years later. The courts were still slated to meet in the same, pretty much the same order on the same day, except the calendar puts them one day off, you know, the way the calendar shifts. And in, but instead of 5,000 people showing up or 4,622 in Worcester, you know, it's less than 1,000. But that rebellion, it had some bloodshed and it got some press and it got named after one individual, which of course was bogus because that guy Shays wasn't, Daniel Shays wasn't even part of the rebellion in the initial stages. But he gets a name and then it gets noted. And or how about the Whiskey Rebellion? You know who named the Whiskey Rebellion? That was Hamilton named that, you know, because to denigrate the insurgents. A lot of rebellions are done to either they name it after one person, which kind of negates the popular furor that goes behind it, you know, and so it gives the image of one person as ordering his troops. And in the text versions of this, in the textbooks, you say Shays led his followers and that kind of stuff. And it inverts history. Popular rebellions tend to be popular rebellions because they're popular, and leaders emerge from them. They do not direct them. So it's a whole inversion of the historical process.
Interesting. Well, let's move to your work in constitutional myths, what we get wrong and how to get it right. You lay out essentially, I guess, eight myths that play a big role in even today in terms of the way that the Constitution is interpreted. What do you think is the biggest one?
I don't know. Who's your favorite of your eight children? Who's your favorite?
Well, I have two. I'm not going to say because I don't want them to hear. But
right, exactly. Well, you know, I don't want any of these myths to be flooded.
All right. Well, let's just start with the first. I mean, the idea that the framers opposed a strong federal government, because I spent a lot of time talking to mostly young libertarians who are convinced that the real problem is a strong federal government. We should have very strong local government. Like local governments apparently can do whatever they want, but federal governments we shouldn't have. And there's sort of – that's almost like a two- or three-parter in terms of the myths. But discuss that.
Okay. Well, sure. And this is going to involve Shays' rebellion too because – we have this concept now that government is the government itself, the very nature of government is the bad guy, and the people are the people's liberties are the good guy. Now, if you look at the actual framing of the Constitution and why it was framed, it actually emerged from so-called Shays' Rebellion and other rebellions that were not quite as advanced in other states at the time. In the Articles of Confederation, were purely local. The Congress, the federal, there was no federal Congress. Well, there was no national governing body. Congress had no power at all. All it could do is it couldn't raise taxes. All it had to just ask the states, hey, can you guys give me some taxes so I can do something? And then the states didn't pay because during the war, they ponied up, always reluctantly and never quite what they should, but they ponied up. After the war, they just stopped paying. And so, I can't remember the exact number because it's been a couple of years since I wrote the book. But in the 6 months prior to the Constitutional Convention, the federal government pulled in less than $1,000, you know, to run the government. And so, you know, what can you do with that? You can't do anything. They had no funds to call out the National Guard to, or any kind of national force to suppress the rebellion in Massachusetts. And people panicked. And people panicked like, you know, they said, we need a government. Because the whole thing is based on the social contract theory of government, that people form governments for their mutual protection. And when there is no government, we revert to a state of nature, which is anarchy. And that means the war of all against all. A strong man can steal from a weak man without consequence. And that is where people thought they were headed if all these rebellions came through. So leaders in various states, and by leaders now I mean not popular leaders but more or less the upper crust, came down and said, we need a real government. And there's a great line, actually, that I use in there, which says, this is from the Pennsylvania Gazette Press right during the Constitutional Convention. It says, 1776 was a revolution in favor of liberty. This year, 1787, is a revolution in favor of government. And the idea was to create a government that would protect the people and bring this thing together, you know, to create a national entity so that the whole thing didn't just fly apart. That's the reason for the convention. And somehow people invert it and say, oh, yeah, it was to preserve our rights. They didn't do anything about rights. They didn't. And on 5 days before the end of the convention, people were all tired out. And it's September 12th, and they've been meeting for 3.5 months. You know, George Mason says, hey, how about a Bill of Rights? One other guy supports them, you know, Geary from Massachusetts. And that's it. And they failed to get the vote of a single state delegation for a Bill of Rights. And they said, listen, we're all about government and the very idea, you know, we're telling what the government can do. And that's what we're telling. And there's no reason to think that it would do anything else.
And give us a sense about the framers' relationship to taxes. I mean, what is, you know, I should say that in each chapter you start with there's a kernel of truth here, and then, but it's basically been extrapolated and mutated in a wrong fashion. What is it that the notion that the framers hated taxes, or maybe you've just explained it to us, it's the only way to fund a government.
Yeah. The whole point, the point of the, if, you know, you want a one-liner about why the framers created a constitution, it's so Congress could tax. That's why. Congress had no funds. There was no federal government. There was no army. There was no protection. There was no federal program of any sort for commerce to regulate shipping, anything like that. They needed money. And all down the line, Washington, Madison, all these guys say, you know, the one thing we really need to get out of this is the power to tax, the power to tax. And when they started suggesting the Bill of Rights, you know, Washington says, you know, I can accept all these other Bill of Rights, but just don't weaken the power to tax. That would cut into the whole thing. So, you know, talk about an inverted narrative. I mean, that was it. Now, this isn't saying that they should tax through the roof or anything, but they gave them pretty much unrestricted power to tax. The only thing that was off the table really was export taxes. And there were regulations for how to do certain taxes. For instance, direct taxes had to be apportioned according to the states. The direct tax is sort of where you tax the people, but an indirect tax is more like a tariff, and that could be whatever. But, you know, they had some regulations about it. But the main thing was power to tax, because the power of the purse, that's it.
And ultimately, I mean, we had to pass an amendment to introduce an income tax. I mean, that's where what they lacked, right, was the power to tax directly?
You know, no. Actually, the thing is they always had the power to do an income tax. There was nothing against it. The only reason they didn't in those days do an income tax is they had no way of computing income. But states, check this out. States had property taxes because, you know, they didn't keep records for their income. You know, what's the income of a farmer? How are you going to judge that? 90% of the people are farmers. You know, what are you going to charge each egg they lay? You know, I mean, the chickens lay and then they eat. You know, it makes no sense at all. So you know how they figured property tax? What rent would this property produce if you set it to rent? In other words, what kind of income could you generate if you wanted to generate income from your property? In other words, and that's how they valued things.
So it's resale value. It's what revenue would it be?
If you rented it out, what would it be? In other words, they clearly would have had an income tax if that was doing, because that's what they were essentially doing. Now the direct taxes, they always had the power to do an income tax. They had it in the Civil War. There was income taxes,
What's his problem?
Excuse me for one second.
You have to understand, people.
Apologize. Go ahead.
Income taxes. Income tax is a direct tax. It's on people, and there was a place in there that said direct taxes have to be apportioned according to the states. And that turned out to be totally undoable. And the Supreme Court then, turned down income taxes because they weren't properly, because there was no way to, they weren't proportioning according to the states. So the income tax simply cleaned up the tax code and saying, listen, you no longer have to apportion them according to the states. Read it carefully. That's what it is. The income tax itself was illegal. It was held to, the Civil War ones were upheld. It was only a conservative court that knocked it down on a technicality, and then the technicality was overdone by the income tax amendment. So this is an example of self-serving. It's not just people. It's not just leaders who did that. People who don't like income taxes have just not read closely on history. And I'm a historian. I'm not at this point a political activist. I was in the '60s. I was in the civil rights movement, but that's a different story. Like now, I'm not out beating any big horn or anything. I'm a historian, and it just riles me to see people, for their own self-serving needs, thinking that big government was the founders' issue or taxes were the founders' issue, that they didn't like any of that, when it's a total inversion of the story. Now, this isn't to say that they had all the answers, but just if you're going to talk about the founders and claim their authority, know what you're talking about.
And the other thing that I think really comes across in the context of your book is that I think it makes sense when one just sort of contemplates it, but we have lionized and deified the framers so much that the idea that there was a certain amount of horse trading and unsatisfaction with the document, and it's like, well, this is the best we could do. We're all exhausted. Let's go home now. It's just too hard for us to, I think, as a popular culture to absorb this. But I mean, that was basically it, right? I mean, these framers were just were not as impartial and I guess above it all as we imagine.
They were every one of them had their own interests of their own constituency in mind, and every one of them had the greater interest of the whole in mind. And that's always a balancing act. Now, today, sometimes I would say the greater interest of the whole has often disappeared, hence we have the gridlock and stuff. But both of those things, they're not mutually exclusive. Give me a break. We're humans. I mean, that's the way people are, people are representing constituencies, and they are fighting. For instance, in that case, South Carolina. Threatened to walk out over issues about slavery. If the Constitution came down too hard on slavery, they were going to walk. But on the other hand, most of them said, okay, we'll overcome the differences, we'll do compromises, and they, at the end, they had a little ritual where all the big guys, except for basically Mason and Randolph and Geary. Kind of came forth and said, this thing ain't perfect. Well, they didn't use ain't. this thing is not perfect. But we need a start. Let's get this thing rolling. We have two ways to amend it, and let's see where it takes us. Now, after the convention, this is a great, I think, story to see how the Constitution gets interpreted in two different ways. After the convention, a woman comes up and asks Benjamin Franklin, of course, who was the culture hero of the day and world famous and everything, but just totally down home, guy. And they said, okay, Dr. Franklin, what did you give us? Monarchy or republic or, what did you give us? And he says, a republic, if you can keep it. Now, when you look at that phrase, republic, if you can keep it, I know Pat Buchanan likes to quote that phrase, and he focuses on the keep, if you can keep it. In other words, keep it, preserve it, in the museum, just the way it is, just the way it is. And that's not at all what I read into it. I put the focus on if a republic, if you can keep it. In other words, we've started you off. We've let the basic ground rules are here. We have empowered you. We've given you something by which you can have your republic. Now, a republic means that people, through their representatives, it's not direct democracy, it's by representative democracy in a republic. You know, the representatives make the call, but they're based on the people. They determine what's up, what's good for the country, okay? If you have them looking back to other people who were dead for 100 and 200 years to determine how best to do airport security, you don't have a republic. You're basing it on some kind of historical phantom that these guys might have said. The republic is you are making your decisions, and we have given you the tools to make your decisions. That's what they did. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to create a government strong enough to stand on its own, raise money, in which the people's representatives could make decisions, not based on the past, but based on the present.
And to what extent, your eighth myth is that we can divine from the Constitution specific instructions based upon what their supposed original intent or meaning was. I mean, what do you have a sense as to what the framers, to the extent that they all agreed on this? I mean, and it's also interesting, too, that, I mean, the idea that they're drafting this based upon what's good for all, what's good for their own constituents. To what extent did it have to do with the future? I mean, I know you've touched on that with it, but I mean, how much in their consciousness, or do we know, was that like, we've got to make something that's really durable for 200, 300 years? Or was that just sort of, was that, you know, let's be honest.
Absolutely none of them had that in mind, because that's the whole, every one of them said, listen, we've got this amendment process. It's very important. Everyone said that this is not perfect. We want to give it a start so we can move this show along. And people, when new contingencies come up, can deal with it. And we have given you the structure. There are two different ways to initiate amendments. And you can read things the way you read them. Now, originalism is a myth. And I'm going to give you an example that actually Scalia, who is, there's two forms of originalism. Justice Thomas believes in original intent. You know, you can just read the framers' mind. And Scalia uses original meanings. What did people at the time when they ratified the Constitution think they were ratifying, you know? But if you look, he gives an example, and I really like his example. And he says, now let's say that that somebody accused of, he's arrested for shoplifting, okay? And the local sheriff takes him in and gives him 50 lashes across his hands for shoplifting. Okay, and he takes that to the Supreme Court. He says that's cruel and unusual punishment. What would an originalist say? An originalist would say, no, it's not. That was a common punishment. It's not unusual at all. That's what people did then. They lashed hands. That's not an unusual punishment. And it has to be cruel and unusual. So the sheriff was totally within his rights to do that. Now, there's been no constitutional amendment to change that. That's the originalist words. How can an originalist justify that? The thing is, nobody, not Scalia or Thomas or anybody else, actually practices originalism. These guys use an originalist argument to defend Citizens United, you know, which is just the most ridiculous thing in the world. The founders, the whole point of creating this republic was to put it beyond personal influence. Influence was the worst word in those days. Get this in the public sphere, no private influence. And these guys, to the T, would have been all over. They just would have embraced every campaign finance reform you can get. Because influence, they didn't want private interest to influence government. That's what a republic was. It was you elect leaders, and then because they're wise and virtuous and above influence, they make wise decisions. And so Citizens United strikes at the very heart of the foundation of the government, you know, not just any particular issue, but just what they were all about. And yet people say, well, the founders, you know, and then he quotes something about freedom of speech or something, which wasn't the issue at all. The issue was creating a government that was beyond private influence.
Well, on that note, Ray Raphael, the book is Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. Thank you so much for your time today. Apropos, as I believe today or tomorrow is the five-year anniversary for that Citizens United ruling. A good place to leave it. Thank you so much for your time today. And, of course, we will link to Constitutional Myths and your other books at majority.fm.
Thanks so much, Sam. You got me. Whenever I start talking about this, I start getting enthused, you know, just to try to get people thinking historically and thinking honestly.
Indeed, and genuinely appreciate it. Thank you so much, Ray Raphael. We've got to take a break, folks. Boom, boom.
Well, how would Scalia account for that?
We've moved into the future. We've got a lot of good stuff on the fun half of the program. I don't know if we'll do too much previewing of the State of the Union address. I'll probably be on Twitter quite a bit tonight, particularly for the rebuttals. Those are particularly fun. But we've got some great sound. I mean, let me just give you a little teaser, folks. Tea Party has finally stepped in and taken Martin Luther King back. Oh, and I should – I will give you an update on my colonoscopy in the fun half.
Sounds really fun.
Yeah, no. It's going to be super fun.
Yeah.
All that
drives those members.
What's that?
That's what drives those members.
Oh, indeed, yes. That's why.
Stop wasting time. Just get the colonoscopy ready. What reason, do you think I pay for this membership for?
Reason number. Well, actually, this is probably like number two on why to become a member.
I so wish that I could give you some type of ill-fitting sound effect.
People have been waiting for a long time.
Would you give yourself a groan?
People have been waiting for a long time for me to get my colonoscopy. I've been a member. We get emails all the time. I've been a member for over 3.5 years now, yet you have yet to go back in for your next colonoscopy.
I see emails like, I love being a member of the show. It's the best show, the best podcast like this. If you just could spend a little bit more time asking for financial support and maybe just have an extra colonoscopy a year, I would prefer it.
Indeed. Folks, you can become a supporter of this program today, at this very moment, by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member. We rely on you for 99% of our revenue, folks. But for that other 1%, if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. Go there, click on the link, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a little kickback. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. That's a win. All right, the number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Or you can IM me at Majority FM on any of your instant message clients, or pick up the app. It's completely free. Why wouldn't you do that? We'll be right back after this.
Sitting at the table.